Hello and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. First up, in a few minutes, we'll speak with Alyssa Katz, who is the author of Our Lot, How Real Estate Came to Own Us, a taxonomy and history of the entire pathology of home ownership, which is now bearing rather rotten fruit. But Alyssa will be here to tell us about the fat years and the lean years that have succeeded the end of the fat years. And then at the bottom of the hour, we will be joined in the studio by Eliza Featherstone, who is the author of a piece in the Nation, their June 29 issue, Out of Reach, about how students really can't afford college and what we could do about it. And we'll be joined on the phone by Adolph Reed, who frequent guest on Behind the News, but who is also part of a Labor Party campaign to make tuition at public colleges free. And we will talk to him about that campaign and to both of them about the problems of student debt and the expenditures of achieving that middle-class icon, a college degree. Before all that, some words on the economic news. The mixed bag theme continues. On Thursday morning, the Labor Department reported some deterioration in the unemployment claims figures, contrary to a recent trend of improvement. First-time claims, those filed by people who've just lost their jobs, rose by 15,000 to where they were about a month ago. The four-week average, a better way to look at this often volatile series, rose by 1,000. The year-to-year change in this series, which as I've been emphasizing here for some time, has proven an excellent guide to the end of recessions, is still in a downtrend, so the recession end theme is still intact. But this week's surprising uptick isn't a good sign. Neither was the 29,000 increase in the number of continuing claims, that is, the number of people still drawing benefits. Most of last week's sharp decline was still intact, but this increase in the past week is also unwelcome news. These weekly figures can be very hard to adjust for seasonal variation, and they are therefore pretty noisy, so it would be too much to say that the slight improvement in the job market has gone into reverse. But this is worrisome and bears close watching. On Wednesday, the Federal Reserve decided to keep interest rates unchanged, with its target for the rate under the Fed's most direct control, the so-called federal funds rate, still effectively zero. The statement reporting the decision, while noting some slowing in the rate of economic decline, less bad news, but still not good news, as I've been saying here for a while, the Fed still characterized the U.S. economy as weak and likely to stay that way, as they put it, for a time. They also expect inflation to remain subdued and anticipate they will keep interest rates at, as they put it, exceptionally low levels for an extended period. Because they removed some end-of-the-worldish language they'd used in the last statement, some people in the financial markets took this as a hawkish statement suggestive of an imminent tightening. But that strikes me as a demented interpretation. The economy remains very fragile, the Fed knows it, and I'm sure, almost sure, that it will remain indulgent for as long as they can stand it. Since we'll be discussing housing in a few minutes, some words on the state of that market. Sales of existing houses rose modestly in May, while sales of new houses fell. Since the market for existing houses is four or five times as big as the new house market, the overall conclusion is slightly upbeat, but the levels of both are still down from a year ago. There's little doubt that sales of foreclosed properties are lifting the sales of existing houses, which isn't really a sign of returning health. The average new house that sold in May had been in the market for almost a year, more than twice the long-term average of time on the market, and an all-time record. Prices are also looking weak, with the average existing house price off 16% from May 2008. That's a little better than April's all-time low, but not much. The new house market showed a little more lift, with prices down just 3% from a year earlier, compared with being down almost 14% for the year ending in April, but sales are down over 30% from a year earlier. So on balance, the familiar theme, some less bad news, but still no good news. Well, although one exception here, one bit of good news. The sales of durable goods, items designed to last 3 years or more, rose almost 2% in May. And for capital goods, meaning the machines that businesses invest in, which are the principal motor of long-term economic growth, that was up almost 5% in May. Additionally, the Kansas City Fed's survey of manufacturing in its neighborhood was up for the first time since August. So maybe the bloodletting in manufacturing is coming to an end. Maybe. In the Economic Cycles Research Institute's weekly leading index, designed to forecast changes in the broad economy 3 to 6 months out, continues its improvement, suggesting that we could be exiting the recession by fall. That doesn't mean that happy days are here again, but it does suggest that this is not 1931 all over again. Turning to the outside world, 40 of the world's governments, convening under the auspices of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the Paris-based think tank and chat shop dominated by the rich countries, agreed that what they're calling green growth is the way out of the economic morass. The 40 countries represented account for about 80% of world economic activity and included, aside from the usual gang of rich countries of the North, the so-called BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, and China. The OECD's Secretary General, Angel Gurria of Mexico, said that participants, as he put it, have made a solemn pledge to promote environmentally friendly green growth policies in favor of sustainable economic growth based on low-carbon energy use. Two clichés come to mind on reading that statement. Let's hope so, and we'll see. This meeting was in part preparation for the UN Climate Change Conference to be held in Copenhagen in December. You do have to wonder whether the pretty words from the OECD communique will translate into any actual commitments in Copenhagen. But changing the prevailing discourse from going green as a cost, in narrowly economic terms, to a potential benefit, also in economic ones, could make a big difference, especially in a time of recession when it's so tempting to cut corners. And finally, a rather telling quote from the conservative Democratic Senator Ben Nelson of Nebraska, explaining why he was opposed to the public option, that is, including it in a health insurance overhaul, a government-run scheme open to all, which is about all that's left of any half-progressive position in Obama's Washington. Commenting on that, Nelson said it would be too attractive and would hurt the private insurance plans. Well, yeah, let's hurt those private plans so bad they die. Yeah. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about housing. And that was some of Haydn's String Quartet number 30, the Scherzo Movement, performed by the Kodaly Quartet. From their wonderful, complete string quartets of Haydn. We are now joined in the studio by Alyssa Katz, who is the author of the book Our Lot, How Real Estate Came to Own Us, just published by, who is it? Bloomsbury.
Bloomsbury.
Yeah, Bloomsbury. It's hard to tell from logos these days. And actually a former worker in this building from some time ago, right?
That's
right. Were you up at City Limits?
Yeah, that was at City Limits magazine for about 6 years, and that's how I first got to know the insanity that was real estate.
Yeah, well, you also have a personal interest in this story, so let's start by talking about that a bit.
Oh, sure, yeah. I mean, this book grew in part out of my experience in 2005 as a tenant at a loft building in Carroll Gardens, Brooklyn. That, you know, one day we got a notice in the mail that that our building had been bought. And the next thing that we got was what's called a red herring. It's this gigantic book offering the apartments for sale and nominally offering them to us for sale, although this was a ridiculous proposition because they were offering our formerly rent-stabilized apartments for sale to us for $600,000, $700,000, $800,000. And this was really an absurd proposition. And so, you know, we organized as a building. I was the president of the Tenants Association, and, you know, we met with the sponsors of this co-op trying to negotiate anything, some protections for tenants, some reasonable discounts on purchase, anything. And we just had pretty much no bargaining power. And at a certain point, really had to back away from the whole thing, and we did move out. But it became a really, really driving inspiration for me to write about what was happening in the real estate bubble, because I think it really affected all of us, and I wanted to share my story.
And then you perhaps against your will, became a subscriber to the American Dream, and now you're a homeowner.
That's right. Well, and one reason that my husband and I did go ahead and buy a place to live, we bought a co-op further out in Brooklyn, was because as tenants in New York City right now, our rights had really systematically been stripped away. And I grew up under rent control in the 1970s in Manhattan. My mom was a civil servant who worked for New York State. My father was a freelance writer, and we were able to live a good middle-class life in Manhattan. And that was possible because we had rent control enabling us to keep housing costs at a reasonable level. And the idea of owning property was just absurd. It just didn't occur to us.
That was for folks in the suburbs.
Yeah, it just was not part of the culture in New York City. It was not part of the economy in New York City. It was nothing. And we had, it wasn't like our building was falling down, which is, you know, you hear critics of rent control frequently saying that, oh, rent control creates slums, it causes deferred maintenance. Well, our building was quite lovely. It was very, very well maintained. It was a beautiful place. And it had always, as far as I knew, been a rental, a luxury rental when it was built in the 20s, but there was nothing wrong with renting. And clearly that changed over time. And as I recount in the book, the major reason it changed in New York, Massachusetts, California, and other places that had rent control was because what we saw was an organized movement to tear it apart, led by landlords primarily and with cooperation from state legislatures. And in New York in 1997, we saw a really aggressive reworking of the rent laws. That the most pernicious aspect of that was vacancy decontrol, which, of course, is now front and center in Albany, if there ever is an Albany again, to deal with it. But, you know, with vacancy decontrol, now when an apartment becomes vacant, it effectively, in many cases, can just leave the rent regulation system entirely. And that wasn't exactly what happened to us at 505 Court Street in Brooklyn. Ours was a weird loophole that basically excluded most tenants there from rent regulation, but New York State, as many listeners know, has just lost hundreds of thousands of apartments to rent regulation that are on market rate, and many of them became condos, co-ops, places to own and not to rent.
Well, it was nice to meet another critic of the American fetish of homeownership, because there aren't very many of us, but this fetish goes way back. David Roediger has a chapter in one of his recent books about how becoming an owner rather than a renter was part of the process of becoming white for immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe. So this goes back to the early 20th century. Your part of the story starts with Herbert Hoover in the 20s. So tell us about the Hoover and the origin of the homeownership fetish.
Yeah, well, you know, Hoover he was a Secretary of Commerce at the time before he was president. And, you know, you have to remember that in the 1920s, this was kind of coming on the crest of a whole wave of tenant unrest that had emerged in the teens and was ongoing. And there was a real concern on the part of many business leaders about trying to keep that in line. And while we didn't have then this kind of apparatus that emerged after World War II to really finance homeownership on a massive scale that really required government intervention, on a much smaller level, what you saw was different players in real estate, housing construction, home furnishings, lighting fixture suppliers, promoting this idea of home ownership and really encouraging anyone who could achieve it to do so.
Though there are also supposedly social benefits, right? You became better people.
That's right. And, you know, I think the idea then as now, it's pretty much the same, that someone who owns their home, has a stake in it, is more likely to protect that interest. And arguably, when someone is actually paying their own money for that home and they have a large amount of equity in that home, that is, you know, is arguably the case. I mean, you may disagree with that, but it's you know, you have something there, you have a nice new car, you don't want to bash it up, and likewise, you might keep your front lawn a little bit cleaner. The problem, of course, with that idea is that, you know, from the very beginning of mass home ownership, it has been financed with an incredible amount of debt. And this was true even before we had the Federal Housing Administration creating the 30-year mortgage. You simply had people taking out 5-year mortgages with big balloon payments at the end.
Yeah, and in the 20s, it took several pounds of flesh to buy a house, right?
Absolutely, and people did it anyway because of all the pressures and aspirations to, I mean, just now, then as now, if you wanted to buy a nice home in the suburbs, I'm sorry, if you wanted to live in a nice home in the suburbs, it was available for sale, not for rent.
Although if you drive around northern New Jersey now, I can see there are a lot of for rent signs there, but that's necessity, not choice.
Absolutely.
There were a lot of changes that the Roosevelt administration brought to the house purchase market. Tell us about those.
Well, yeah, I mean, this was very much out of necessity. You know, we may have heard a lot recently about the Homeowners Loan Corporation. This was this emergency measure to refinance all the nation's homes on a massive scale. And I think
there are a lot of defaults and foreclosures.
A huge number, specifically because of what I was talking about. People would take out these mortgages that only lasted for 3 years or five, and they expected, just like a subprime borrower might recently, they expected to be able to refinance their loans. But once the Depression hit and banks were insolvent, the lenders simply could not refinance the homes, or even if they did have the money to lend, the property values had plummeted so precipitously it simply wasn't possible to refinance. And so what the Homeowners Loan Corporation did is basically created a do-over. The homeowners would get a new appraisal, get a new loan, and get on with their lives. And it's interesting to note that that's not happening right now simply because Treasury and so, concerned with keeping the banking system afloat and making sure that borrowers can make good on their obligations to whatever extent it's at all possible, that there's been an extreme reluctance to even consider this kind of wiping the slate clean and moving on. We have these loan modification efforts and refinancing programs that really only reach a very, very limited number of people.
Maybe we need 10,000 bank failures like we had in the early 30s to clear the decks.
Yeah.
Then at the end of World War II, it became national policy to subsidize homeownership in a big way.
Right? Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what we had was the Veterans Administration and Federal Housing Administration insured home mortgages and also insured them specifically on, under a couple of circumstances. One, they had to be 30-year long-term amortized mortgages. And this was huge because it basically took debt that, like I said, had just basically been this ticking time bomb and turned it into something that one could reasonably repay over one's lifespan. So it became, in effect, a really huge transfer of wealth to this emerging middle class that proved very, very powerful. And the other aspect of FHA is that the houses that were insured had to, for very intricate and awful reasons, essentially had to be in the suburbs. The FHA encouraged what's known as redlining, which is a systematic exclusion of cities, of largely minority areas, of any place that they deemed was in a later stage of its life cycle. There was actually this ideology that neighborhoods had a natural kind of birth, middle age, and death, and that it was irreversible. The whole idea that we understand now that neighborhoods can be revived, gentrified, any of that was not on anyone's mind. And so it became a self-fulfilling prophecy. Cities were systematically excluded from credit, and that's why so many urban areas struggled so mightily in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and into the 80s because they had just been drained of resources and buyers had to go to the suburbs to have any chance to buy a home.
Speaking of Melissa Katz, who is the author of Our Lot, How Real Estate Came to Own Us, just out from Bloomsbury, USA. All right, let's step forward to the recent past. When it became national policy under the Clinton administration to promote homeownership with all kinds of creative financing. Tell us about Bill Clinton's third way approach to housing.
Well, it was funny. As I note in the book, Clinton's full-throated support for home ownership for all started out happening by accident. He was on the campaign trail in his first race, and one of his aides was he was a housing geek, the Columbia urban planning professor who had written about this history we just discussed of FHA and really wanted to see this become part of the Clinton agenda. Ended up basically making a promise on the behalf of the candidate that they would work to create a record high number of homeowners. And then once Clinton got into office, they then had to fulfill this mandate. And Clinton didn't initially have a whole lot of power to do that. The FHA by that point had become this kind of calcified bureaucracy that couldn't compete with the emerging subprime market. They didn't, have a lot of control over private actors, but what they really could do was, one, put a lot of pressure on industry players to continue to lower their lending standards to basically enable more and more potential borrowers to qualify. That was really the only way that the home ownership rate could be increased, because upwards of 90% of white suburban American households that had already owned their home. That market was essentially tapped out, and the only way for Clinton to achieve his goal was to expand minority home ownership, expand urban home ownership, expand immigrant home ownership, and capture these new markets. And so they engaged in a political campaign to make that happen, and it continued later on to really push Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which were under close government regulation, to finance mortgages specifically for those target groups. And the problem was that in order to reach them, and we should get into subprime because that's a huge part of the story, they had to go and sort of go in a race to the bottom, essentially, to try to find ways to lend more money to more people more cheaply.
Yeah, I was just about to say that Clinton found some assistance from a fellow named Angelo Mozilla, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Angelo Mozilla was the earliest, he was really first on board with the Clinton program. It was called National Home Ownership Strategy. And at the time, Mozilla was also head of the Mortgage Bankers Association. So he put that power to work and began his own campaign in tandem with the government effort to reach urban areas, black and Latino borrowers. They were the first to get out there with materials and marketing. And it was multilingual in Vietnamese, Russian, any language that their market might speak. And I have to add that Connie Bruck's profile of Mozilla in The New Yorker this week is a must-read. Really, really great portrait of just the man's mad ambition and, you know, how he's sort of less. I mean, he's certainly a villain, but as much as anything, he's just somebody who couldn't stop because he was just so driven to do what we're talking about.
Well, Marx said something about how the apostles of credit have a nicely mixed character of swindler and prophet, and I guess Mozilla was in that tradition.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? but of course, Countrywide was his company that he pumped out lots and lots of loans to people who really shouldn't have been borrowing. Right?
Yeah, and it's interesting. I mean, as Bruck knows, why Countrywide actually has become kind of the poster child for abusive lending, because in fact, I mean, yes, it had a very bad subprime division called Full Spectrum, and Countrywide did end up promoting a lot of option arms and other really dangerous loan products. Really, the most pernicious companies were ones that often flew under the radar and often would go out of business before anyone really quite picked up on what was going on. I mean, we saw this throughout the 1990s. One thing that's just so appalling about the subprime crisis more recently is that all of the features that came to explode, right, the high and adjustable interest rates, the very little money down, borrowers who were clearly not in a position to pay back and were not ultimately going to benefit from the loan, prepayment penalties, fees, all of that was in place already by the early 90s. And that's why Congress passed something called the Home Ownership Protection Act of 1994. And this was supposed to have stopped this in its tracks. And it didn't. And there's just two words for why that didn't, and that was Alan Greenspan. He had the baton, and he didn't run with it.
Yeah, well, talk more about Greenspan. I'd love to kick him around.
Well, Greenspan had an enormous amount of authority to regulate the mortgage markets and explicitly under the Homeowners Equity Protection Act. And, in fact, once these predatory lending cases started coming to courts in the 1990s, again, just really horrible situations of often elderly homeowners who pretty much own their homes free and clear, and somebody would drive by and say, oh, we can fix a roof for you, and then set them up with a horrible subprime loan. When these cases came to courts, the judges, often Republican judges, Republican-appointed judges, would say, well, sorry, we can't do anything about that because, you know, the Fed was supposed to have decided on these questions in the Home Ownership Equity Protection Act, and, you know, they never did, and so, sorry, you're out of luck.
Yes. Well, there's plenty of people who knew what was going on. There are plenty of opportunities to stop it. I had people on this show in the late 90s, early 2000s who talked about what was going on. Some of it, you know, very brand-name Wall Street firms doing it so at arm's length with subsidiaries and other relationships, but we should have known better, right?
Well, absolutely. I mean, this stuff was going on for a very, very long time, and borrowers were succumbing to foreclosure at really alarmingly high rates that were really concentrated in specific cities, specific neighborhoods, almost inevitably heavily minority neighborhoods, and it became a really serious plague, including in you know, New York City, became a huge problem in Chicago that groups there documented very closely. And my sense is that the only reason that this didn't become a national issue or a cause for alarm then was because investors were getting paid. This was part of the business model. These loans were priced to fail. In other words, borrowers are paying very high interest rates, high fees that made up for the risk of foreclosure. And because the bubble was building, property values were rising so that once those borrowers did go into foreclosure, the lender could simply resell that property and gain in the process. And in fact, I note in the book how it was a subprime mortgage pool tied to Long Beach Mortgage, which is a company that begat AmeriQuest, which begat Argent. And this is what I was saying about companies that keep morphing. And even as their foreclosure rates went up, their ratings from the Standard & Poor's and Moody's went up. And, you know, because the performance of the securities kept improving.
Now, almost always in a bubble of any sort, there's a mix of everything from just naivete through malignant optimism to outright criminality. We've only got a minute or so left, but what's your judgment of the mix involved in this crazy bubble?
I think outright criminality encouraging naivete in an unimaginable degree. I mean, the mix of both is astounding, and often in the same people who were the villains were often taken by others. There were just many layers of exploitation, and that went all the way down the line. Almost everyone was in on it.
And just in the final seconds, what's your judgment? A lot of people talking about the housing market looking like it's approaching some sort of bottom. Do you think it's going to stick around for years to come?
It really depends on what happens with federal policy, right? The Obama administration just announced this big plan last week to reform the financial system, and the whole point of it is to get the credit markets rekindled again and charged up at a high flame. And so really it depends on how willing Americans are going to be to take on debt again, to live the American dream. Are they going to fall for it again? Are they going to embrace this idea and commit themselves to indebtedness for a very long term when they may not have to and there may be alternatives? So the question is, how much are they forced once again to pursue the path they pursued for so long?
Yeah, it seems like the approach is just to try to bring back the good old days.
Yes. It ain't coming back.
Doesn't seem very promising. Okay, thanks for joining us. I've been speaking with Alyssa Katz, who is the author of Our Lot, How Real Estate Came to Own Us, just out from Bloomsbury. And there's many things we didn't touch on. A fine chapter on the devastation wrought on Cleveland and many other things in the book, too. So if you want to figure out how this housing mess happened, you can do no better than to read this book. Thanks for joining us, Alyssa, and good luck with it.
Thank you, Doug.
All right, let's take a break, and we'll be back to talk about student distress. And this is WBAI in New York, not only at 99.5 on your FM dial, but also on the web at WBAI.org. And if you visit the website, please be sure to click that donate button. And we will be doing some summer fundraising in a few weeks, but in the interim, we can always use every penny you can send our way. So please consider doing that. And things are looking up around here, so all the more reason to do that than ever. All right, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about the cost of college.
We favor the simple expression of the complex thought. We are for the large shape because it has the impact of the unequivocal. Are for flat forms because they destroy illusion and reveal truth.
And that's some of the song Sideshow at Free University from La Tigre, which doesn't have much to do with the next topic except for the title. We're now joined in the studio by Liza Featherstone, who is a contributing editor to The Nation magazine, and full disclosure requires me to admit that she is my wife and the love of my life, but I stand to gain no material benefit from having her on here to talk about her piece in June 29th edition of The Nation, Out of Reach. And then we're also joined on the phone by Adolf Reed, professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania, who is with the Labor Party, which is pushing a free tuition scheme for public universities. So welcome to you both.
Hi, guys. How you doing?
All right, Liza, let's start with you. Here in New York City, we used to have free tuition for more than a century at CUNY, right?
That's right. Well, it was City College was founded in 1847 with the idealistic goal, according to founder Townsend Harris, that children of the rich and poor would take their seats together and know of no distinction save that of industry, good conduct, and intellect. And it was indeed free until 1976.
When Felix Rotin, who was the master of the city at the time, said we had to end it for the shock value, as he said during the fiscal crisis. And it certainly did transform consciousness, because the idea of free tuition now seems like a dreamy impossibility for some future utopia, not something that we had in New York City for 130 years.
Yeah, that's right. And in the same period, Ronald Reagan said an educated proletariat, that would be dynamite.
Did he actually say that?
Yep. Can't have it.
We don't want that. No, we want, sounds like Frank Zappa used to say things like that. But,
yeah. Exactly.
So what are the dimensions of the problem? I mean, what kind of financial burden do students face to go to college? It's been a long time since I faced it personally. So give us some measure of the national problem.
Oh, but you will be facing it.
Yes.
Since we have a child.
So. Yes, 15 years in the future.
Yeah. It's really pretty serious. About two-thirds of students graduate in debt. It's about $22,000 per student on average, that debt, which of course means many graduate with a much more burdensome and crippling debt than that. A 2007 study of college freshmen found that about 10% were not sure they would have the funds to graduate. And that, of course, does not even count the millions of students who are now just passing up the opportunity to go to college because of cost. That's the United States Students Association, a group that lobbies on these issues in D.C., projects that over the next decade, about 3.2 million qualified students will not go simply because of the expense.
And this, of course, is a time when we constantly hear that's the only way to get into the middle class is to get a college degree. But that route is a difficult one to embark on, isn't it?
It is. I mean, and, you know, I should say it is also true that some of that is about a little bit about the denigration of blue-collar jobs, you know, that not everybody really has to go to college to, you know, be happy and make a good enough living, you know, and there has been a devastation of decent vocational education at the high school level as well. But that said, most people are going to be better off and be more thoughtful and productive citizens if they go to college, and most people are going to be better able to make sense of their life and contribute to democracy. So,
that's the educated proletariat part.
That's the trouble. Yeah.
But what's happening with the recession and the fiscal crises all over the country? I imagine there's cuts in aid and increases in tuition.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, cuts in financial aid and tuition hikes just about everywhere, that has been particularly bad at public universities, where most state legislatures are finding increasing tuition to be a convenient way to patch up just enormous gaping holes in the state budgets.
And meanwhile, these public institutions are getting less and less from their legislatures and more from tuition and other private sources.
That's right. That's right. Many are effectively privatized anyway, but what little state aid they have is being cut, and tuition is being passed along. The tuition costs are being passed along to students. And at many universities, students are protesting this.
Yeah, that was my next question. What kind of organized or semi-organized opposition is there to this agenda?
Yeah, it's been pretty widespread. There have been all throughout this spring, there were walkouts at City College, which is what we began the conversation about, throughout the CUNY system. About 1,000 at the University of Vermont walked out, students throughout the California system and Central Washington, really all over the country. And the basic point is, students are, they are saying, look, college was pretty much unaffordable for us already, and you are effectively, as one student said, treating us like ATMs, using the poorest and people with least resources in order to patch up a failing system.
But you did discover an interesting fissure among the students. Those on total financial aid are less interested in this issue than those are only partial.
That's right. It's a funny, the system creates certain political distortions where its tuition hikes are in some way a slightly more middle class or prosperous working class issue, because if you are very poor and you are at college and qualified to be there, you are getting financial aid, for the most part. And so a lot of the protesters are finding that, their friends, particularly at schools that are predominantly minority or low income, are not too concerned because they feel they're on financial aid and they're okay. The problem is the continuing increase in tuition puts an enormous burden on those financial aid programs, and so the programs themselves are in the long term imperiled anyway. But the programs do create a sense that people have different interests.
Mm-hmm. That's the voice of Liza Featherstone, who is the author of Out of Reach, which is in the June 29th edition of The Nation magazine. We also have on the phone Adolf Reed, who is a professor of political science at University of Pennsylvania, columnist for The Progressive magazine. And first, Adolf, the students at your university are generally anything but low income, are they?
That's right. They are generally anything but low income.
how is the tuition squeeze affecting them, though?
Well, there hasn't been much in the way of that I've noticed of public discussion about it, much less outrage. I think partly, as Liza noted, places like Penn make a big deal out of it being able to provide aid for the, if you can pardon the Reaganism, for the truly needy, mm-hmm. right, for the poorest of the poor, who are protected and are to some extent insulated from the tuition increases. My sense is, I'm not sure about this at all. But my sense is that of course at the top of the heap are the students who are so well off, or whose families are so well off that they never really think about the tuition cost anyway. And then there's this other wager that students at places like this make, that this is an investment that's going to either hold their position in the upper class or ease their way into the upper class. And if you think about it like that, I think maybe a lot of those parents and the students themselves, well, a very small percentage of the students at a place like Penn are actually burdened with having to come up with their own tuition, basically. So it's more of their parents' problem.
But I imagine some of them must graduate with debts in the high five or low six figures.
Oh yeah, absolutely. No, that's absolutely right. And you see the same sort of same kind of ideology up and down the food chain, right? The presumption is, and there are many different forces, as you guys both have alluded to, that encourage students to take out. Or to take on debt like this along the way, on the grounds that the payoff is going to come down the road, and when you're at an Ivy League institution, then you assume that the payoff is going to be one of those the equivalent of one of those fat Goldman Sachs jobs, in which case $100,000 of a loan debt doesn't seem like the worst thing in the world. Of course, it does.
You can pay that off with your first bonus, and
pretty
then
much.
Have enough left over to buy a Jaguar.
Right, exactly. But of course, you know, part of the story here is that you know, the increasing debt burden that students have had to carry over the last 30 years has channeled you know, the courses of study that you people are inclined to follow, has channeled, you know, the career choices or the career directions that, you know, students are inclined to try to pursue. I mean, nobody can come out of college anymore and you go into an organizing collective, you know, for instance. You know, the closest you can hope for is a job with some public interest organization that has a loan forgiveness program, or if you go to work for SEIU and you know, one of the other chains to win unions and you make enough money to pay some of the loan debt back. And I think that's another element of, you know, the facet of the problem. I mean, one other I'd like to mention too is that, this isn't really directly connected to increasing student debt, but the fiscal crisis or the economic crisis in higher education is presenting administrators and boards of trustees and others who want to go in this direction with another opportunity, right? It's another one of those occasions when, you know, the crisis is too good a thing to waste, to intensify, speed up, to reorganize, to you know, attack the tenure system, to cut programs and departments and schools that are seen as not profit centers, especially at second and third tier public and private institutions, to intensify pressure to take as benchmarks for how the college or university should operate, you know, the private for-profits, right? You know, the University of Phoenix or the Sutton School or the others that promise you a career and often, you know, very affecting your TV ads if you watch them. You know, they promise access to what a college degree would give you, and often they call what they give you a BA. That would put you on the track for a secure, your middle-class job that offers a middle-class lifestyle and middle-class dignity in a couple of years without having to take poetry and write and courses that really make you think about anything. And that pressure is intensifying as well. And I think it's also kind of swirling around in a mutually reinforcing way with the stepped-up, you know, right-wing attack on the university as a breeding ground for the adversary culture that you know, that old you know, that old educated troll problem again.
Yeah, if only they were that.
If only.
But they're not. Well, let's. You are also involved in a movement to bring about free college tuition at public universities. So tell us about that.
Well, it's pretty simple, really. I mean, we've been doing this since the early years of this decade. As you indicated, it came out of the Labor Party. And the idea is a simple one, that on the model of the post-World War II GI Bill, that the federal government should just pay all tuition and fees for everybody who's enrolled in a public college or university. And it's a laughably cheap expense. I mean, more than 80% of people who are in college at this point are in public institutions, or around 80%. I think the number may have gone down a little bit. So for roughly $40 billion or so, and I think maybe Eliza, you've been able to get more updated numbers than I have, but I think it's probably around $40 billion a year at this point.
Yeah, I got about $80 billion, but
but that's for both public and private.
No, that was just for public.
Really?
Yeah, but maybe I was counting some things that you weren't counting.
Oh, yeah.
40, 80, you know, in the context of a $14 trillion economy.
Well,
it's still 10% of one of the bailouts.
Right. Yeah,
well, you know, a few months ago I was interviewing the filmmakers who put together a movie, or they're trying to put together a movie on student debt, and the number that they came up with is the total amount of student debt outstanding is about $80 billion. The richest 5 people in New York City are worth $90 billion.
Wow.
So mm-hmm. all we have to do is expropriate them, and we can wipe out all the student debt in New York.
Right. Well, yeah. And frankly, yeah, I mean, you know, at $100 billion a year, right, like it's nothing.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. especially when you consider the multiplier effect that would come from having more people go to college, right? And I was listening, Eliza, when you were giving the catalog of student protests, because I think one of the things to be concerned about is, and we've seen this over and again, with earlier cost squeezes and the protests against them, that the political anger, I guess, or action, all too easily winds up getting, all dressed up with no place to go, right, with mm-hmm. nothing to fight for. And this sort of vague or more or less vague, often enough activist-ist views that having some motion will of its own create an agenda and create a groundswell and the protest by itself will somehow create an alternative. From that perspective, I think one of the things that's appealing about an idea like this demand for free public higher education is that it gives you something to fight for,
mm-hmm.
And that also can be the basis for having a bigger discussion and a bigger fight, frankly, over what higher education is supposed to be,
mm-hmm.
and you will be and can be, and from the way the forces of corporatization and privatization are moving in the university now, I got to tell you, I wouldn't be at all surprised that if we can't find some way to turn the corner, I suspect that that when it's time for Ivan to suck up all of your money, we will be hard-pressed, you'll be hard-pressed to find something that looks at all like what the three of us or most other people like us would recognize as a university, mm-hmm. left any place in America.
Well, what about a kind of bifurcated model where places like Penn and Yale carry on in their elite way and then everyone else is sent to a McDonald's of education?
Well, that's what a lot of my colleagues think. But see, the fact of the matter is, I don't think that we'd be likely to escape it either. I mean, what do you need Penn and Yale and Princeton for, right? I mean, you don't really need them to train an educated elite. What you need them for ultimately is a class certification,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, that's
it's reproduction and recruitment for an elite. Yeah.
But that's a pretty important function.
Well, oh, yeah, sure. Well, yeah, but
I mean, if you want to
I think it can continue. Mm-hmm. See, but I think those places can continue to perform that, that function, especially, well, look at, I mean, for a decade or two, the customer service model has been encroaching in those places as well. Students' concerns, not to be taught anything that makes them uncomfortable, makes them think too hard,
mm-hmm.
have been encroaching, in those places as well as they have everywhere else. And, now after like a couple of decades of SAT and other high stakes test driven approaches to education, it's not clear to me that the ability for faculties of critical thought and examination are necessarily that much more likely to be cultivated at the fancy places than at the less fancy places. I mean, you remember Doug in particular back around the around the turn of the 90s, Buckley, Bill Buckley and the others of the National Review ilk, were trying to tout this place. I think it's Hillsdale
College.
As being every bit as good as Harvard, right? And I mean, the idea was, or a part of the idea was, of course, that they could produce, through cheerleading, a new entry, right, to the top tier of elite certifying institutions. Because it's not that those kids have to be any smarter than anybody. I mean, I've been saying this a lot to people about Obama and the group around him too. That it's way too easy to mistake ability to perform convincingly a kind of you know, the trappings of a sort of intellectual sophistication. You get through the room, you know, through every room you need to get through, you know, with people saying that you're really smart, without having any, you know, without having what I think is the crucial grounding for practical intelligence, which is purposiveness, right? And I think what we've seen increasingly is that, you know, at the elite institutions, what you get or can get certainly is polish, right? A sort of superficial polish that that's harnessed to no deeper or profounder or more complex objective than aggregating elite credentials and advancing oneself through the world.
Well, as I recall, my own experience of an elite institution, they're also very good at inculcating the sense that the world is yours by right.
Oh yeah, totally. Which is the cherry on the top of the sundae, or no, actually more. It's what makes the whole thing work, right? I mean, that's how you can you perform that sort of easy and effortless intellectual sophistication, because you know that you're smug and better than everybody else in the world.
We're running low on time, so let me just ask you, Adolf Reed, from University of Pennsylvania, Political Science Department, people who want to find out more about the free tuition movement, what should they do?
Well, I guess the best thing to do would be to go to the website of the Debs Jones Douglas Institute, that's djdi.org, and there's a link to the free higher ed campaign. I'll say, too, that the PSC CUNY, the faculty union, and California Faculty Association, which represents 23,000 faculty in the Cal State system, the UMass Faculty Union, the MSP, and in fact the National AFT have all endorsed this. The state group in Massachusetts, PHENOM, that's doing a lot of interesting stuff on the ground there. At the state level, at the moment, the effort to push for free community colleges also have been involved in this campaign, and I think the next step is to try to figure out how to connect these endorsements and to link and I should say, by the way, these aren't simply paper endorsements, but to connect these nodes of support with the ultimately defensive struggles that everybody's tied down in now, and to find a way to go on the offensive.
And that website again, djdi.org. And we're almost out of time, but Liza, the students that you interview, the student activists, are they all connected to a larger movement? They have any sense of each other, or are they just operating in their own spheres?
They definitely do. They were aware that students everywhere else were also walking out. With the internet, people are pretty, people become aware pretty easily of what other people are doing. However, it was mostly on a pretty defensive level and not with a larger idea of making all higher ed free. But hopefully we can change that.
Well, let's hope so, but this is America where we do things fragmented fashion.
Yep, alas.
Yeah.
All right, I've been speaking with the last voice you heard was that of Liza Featherstone, a contributing editor of The Nation and author of the article Out of Reach in the June 29th issue of The Nation magazine, and also on the phone was Adolf Reed of University of Pennsylvania Political Science Department. And I should say I wanted to apologize. I know that Stonewall, the 40th anniversary of Stonewall is coming up, and I wanted to do a segment on that, but I didn't get to. I apologize for that, because I think it's very important and a wonderful thing to be remembering in the coming days. So please don't take my oversight for a lack of interest. All right, that's it for me, Doug Henwood. I'll be back next week, and let's go out with this song I don't really understand, but it's pretty catchy, from the new Sonic Youth album, Anti-Orgasm. Till next week, bye.